A child whose life and work would make our congregation's existence possible was born just over 500 years ago in a French cathedral town about 50 miles northeast of Paris. He was the fourth among five sons, and his family was not wealthy, but this boy was uncommonly smart. He ingratiated himself into the lives of local priests and nobles, and he found himself at the tender age of just 12, appointed to the honorific and salary-carrying position of chaplain to the local church. On the income granted by this church grant, this brilliant boy went off to study theology at the University of Paris, and this was not a program for the weak of will. A course of work in theology at the University of Paris took students about 15 years to complete, during which most of those students often went without food, without warmth, and without sleep, not because they were poor or deprived in any material sense, but because it was widely understood that this sort of deprivation was the only kind of crucible in which a real theologian could be formed. It just so happens that at the University of Paris in the 1530s, there was among the greatest intellectual gatherings of what has come to be known as the Protestant Reformation. This brilliant young man and his friends passed around copies of the Christian scriptures translated of all the crazy things into English, knowing that to have such a book, a copy of the Christian scriptures translated into English, to have such a book discovered in their possession would be punishable by expulsion or trial as a heretic or even death. You see, before the Reformation, the scriptures were read only by priests. And here, at the turning of the entire religious tide, the whole literate world could get their hands on the gospel and could interpret it for themselves. And they did so in some ways quite variant from the ways the church had taught it before. Our bold student applied himself wholeheartedly to his studies, and the Reformation sentiments that surrounded him at the university burned down deeply into his soul, and risking absolutely everything, this young man dramatically renounced the Catholic Church and gave up the church pension that paid for his schooling, saying, "A dog barks when his master is attacked. I would be a coward if I saw God's truth attacked and yet remained silent another moment." When the church police came to round up the heretics at the University of Paris, all they found of our young reformer was a rope made of twisted bedsheets hanging from his window. He was gone, but not finished. And within a few years of completing his degree, he published a book that one religious scholar has called the most eloquent, fervent, lucid, logical, influential, terrible work in the whole literature of religious revolution. In time, this young man made his way to a Protestant stronghold in Switzerland, and that terrible, marvelous, lucid book of his, The Institutes of Christian Religion, became the great heretical bestseller of its time. Its prognostications about how a Christian life should be lived were so compelling that the city of Geneva in Switzerland chose to turn over their religious, legal, and civic life entirely to him and his ideas. Geneva, before our reformer arrived, you see, was a cesspool of crime and corruption, with a well-earned reputation as a hard-partying drunkard's town full of trademen, merchants, prostitutes, and dirty priests. Their civil government was ineffectual and corrupt, and when the reformer of Geneva came to preach to them, the people overwhelmingly voted a commitment to live by the gospel as he articulated it, which meant that there were no more prostitutes, no more gambling, no more drunkenness, and every citizen of Geneva was not only required to attend church, but to sign a 21-paragraph document affirming their faith in the reformer's view of Scripture. If you did not sign this oath, your citizenship was revoked, and you were banished from the city forever. In addition, the new rule of the gospel in Geneva created a sort of church police whose sole job was to spy on the citizenry and report back to the church if anyone's behavior ran outside of the justifications of the gospel. Crime plummeted. The city prospered. The streets were clean. The people built things for the first time in decades. The city grew. It became one among the intellectual hearts of European Protestantism, and its reformer would become one of the leading lights of the Christian world for the next 500 years. In time, some who were influenced by his austerity and the purity of conduct that brought Geneva back from its cesspool of crime would call themselves Puritans and sail from England to found religious colonies in the New World. They crossed an ocean with copies of his book in the holds of their leaking ships. Like Geneva, those colonies here in the New World were also governed by strict and unyielding ecclesiastical policies and codes of conduct, and managed by church tribunals. Some of those Puritans eventually embraced different ideas about doctrines like the Trinity and the nature of humankind, and went on to become the earliest of American Unitarians. Many of those earliest Puritan churches are Unitarian Universalist congregations to this day. Some of them, like the First Parish in Plymouth, Massachusetts, are approaching 400 years old and are still proud of their Puritan Protestant roots, all of which descended intellectually, structurally, in one way or another, from the work of our most esteemed forebear, the reformer, the child born in France in 1509, bearing the name Jean Chauvin, which was later Latinized into Johannes Calvinius, and shortened to John Calvin. That's right. If we're going to be honest and look at our heritage institutionally, the reformer our tradition modeled itself on from the very beginning is not the reformer I've gathered to talk to you about today. Institutionally, Unitarian Universalism lays, along with the rest of American Protestantism, in a fairly immediate line of descent, coming directly from John Calvin to the Puritans to us. John Calvin, the man who killed Michael Servetus, not Servetus himself, the man whose memory and martyrdom the Unitarian cause has so long justifiably revered. And let me, if you will allow it, make matters even worse. Miguel Serveto Canessa was born in Aragon in what is now Spain, and he was among the most brilliant men of his time. He spoke half a dozen languages, including Greek and Hebrew, when no one else did. He overshadowed even Calvin in theological studies at the University of Paris. He became a teacher of medicine and is credited, of all the wacky things, with being the first European to correctly describe the functioning of the human circulatory system. And do you know what heresy he died for? What Calvin killed him for? Because he claimed that the three persons of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, were in no way separately existing entities, but merely different aspects of the same Godhead. He died because he understood the Trinity to be a manifestation of a unity. Unitarianism, technically, is a denial of the Trinity. So he died for one early expression of the faith that gives us our very name. And here's the tragedy and the opportunity in this Sunday's topic. I would like us to be honest. And let me, in this process of bringing us to a moment of honesty, set the scene for you. Here we are, among the most vibrant of Unitarian Universalist congregations. We are the inheritors of the Unitarian heresy in America. In fact, the Unitarian Universalist Association, of which we are a part, is the largest organization professing itself to be Unitarian in the entire world, and here's the honesty hour. Michael Servetus died for an elaborate distinction between the Trinity as three aspects of one single Godhead and the Trinity as three persons separate but equal, united by that Godhead. It takes theologians months of study to even come close to understanding the differences between Servetus' position and that of Calvin, who killed him for it. It's that complicated. And I'd like you, the holy remnant of Unitarianism on this earth, to raise your hand if you actually profoundly, on the level of your soul, give a hoot about the doctrine of the Trinity. My hand did not go up either. The doctrine that Michael Servetus died for, the beauty and the opportunity and the tragedy of it all is that Unitarianism isn't really about being Unitarian anymore. Who cares about the doctrine of the Trinity? Who cares if your idea of the Trinity is different from mine? Not only will I not kill you for disagreeing with me on this point, but we are likely to both become quite irrevocably bored if we choose to blather on too long about anti-Trinitarianism. It doesn't matter. And moreover, for the vast majority of mainline Christians, it doesn't matter to them either. All of this is a long way of saying two things that I do not think are bad, but do think are important. One, that as a historical body, we have more connection to Servetus' killer than we do to the man himself. And the final kick in the gut, that Michael Servetus' Unitarianism as such isn't really that important in our faith lives today. And yet, he is understood as one of the most revered of our forebears, and he should be. His story is deeply held as a part of our story, and it should be. Not for the reasons we have long pretended, because the truth is that Servetus' theology is not much like ours. Even his way of being religious is not anything like what we practice here on Sunday morning. He would think we were nuts. In some ways, it is not to Servetus' life that we modern heretics owe our existence, but to his death. Because when Michael Servetus was tied to that stake in 1553 and the torch was put to the slow-burning green wood, when he shouted what historians say were his last words, "Jesus, Son of the Eternal God, have mercy on me," for the first time, the Protestant world wondered if the way they were doing church was just as bad as the corruptions they had left behind when they broke with Catholicism. For the first time, fed by the blood of a Unitarian, a new orthodoxy questioned itself. And a little seed was planted in the minds of many, which would grow in time into a genuine religious tolerance and an honest appreciation of theological difference, religious diversity, honest appreciation of difference. Raise your hand if you care about that. Nice. The burning of Servetus was something like the Abu Ghraib of its day, a whistleblowing event so abhorrent and so well publicized that the myriad other corruptions that never make the papers came under scrutiny too. It became a sort of intellectual test case for the justification of the very practice of killing heretics in the Protestant world. After all, the Protestants were themselves being burned all over Catholic Europe as heretics. Would those people who had escaped such violence create more violence that mirrored everything they fled from? While a great many Protestants supported Calvin's choice to kill heretics, others credit the communal disgust at Servetus' death as generating in certain circles the beginning of religious tolerance in Europe and the inspiration for the kind of tolerance that lies at the heart of who we are today. In Geneva, and other Protestant strongholds, fervor and clamor over Servetus' execution was so great that Calvin was forced to publish a justification of his decision to kill him. He called it a defense of Orthodox faith against the prodigious errors of the Spaniard, in which he argued that the death of Servetus protected the eternal souls of untold numbers of people. In response, another reformer named Sebastian Castellio issued a widely read rebuttal which simply declared, "To kill a man is not to defend a doctrine, it is to kill a man." After the fact, Protestant courts eventually came to affirm Calvin's policies. Heretics, those who chose to believe other than the orthodox opinions of whatever church reigned supreme, continued to be burned all over Catholic and Protestant Europe for 100 years. But history, including our own Unitarian history, would come to treat heretics differently, never forgetting the fires of Champnell and the Spaniard who died for what he believed. In America, the last man convicted of blasphemy, the Universalist preacher Abner Kneeland, spent 60 days in jail in 1838, only to be sprung by a petition organized from the great Unitarian preacher William Ellery Channing. In the 20th century, the greatest historian of modern times, Edward Gibbon, said, "I am more deeply scandalized by the single execution of Servetus than at all the fires that blazed at the auto-de-fés of Spain and Portugal." The ever-consuming fires of the Catholic Inquisition were a horror, Gibbon thought. Yet in his heart, he was more disappointed that the Protestants, those who broke free of orthodoxy and suffered at those very fires, would create their own orthodoxies all over again and literally kill to defend them. Michael Servetus died a horrible death because he refused to back away from an idea that we don't even care about anymore. He died, and almost all of his books burned with him, while Calvin went on to become the inspiration for the American religious way of life for most of the founding years of our nation's history. Calvin's book is required reading in every theological school worthy of the name, while virtually no one outside of Unitarian Universalism has ever heard of Servetus. Yet Servetus left a great legacy, and it is not his theology. It is us, the way we are free and indeed compelled to interact with one another and with the world around us. His legacy is not the specific things we believe about the Trinity or anything else. It's our very freedom to believe them. People are always asking Unitarians things like, "What does your church believe in?" And the answer inevitably comes around to the fact that we believe in a great lot of things. Without one central orthodoxy that we must defend, we are a holy hodgepodge of theological positions, and in some ways, we function as a test case for the rest of the world. If these people, all of us, with opinions as varied as the rainbow, can put up with one another and indeed be shaped into better versions of ourselves by worshiping together, maybe, just maybe, the rest of the world needn't kill each other over their differences either. For us, religion is not merely about the particulars of what you believe. It's about how your beliefs, whatever they are, call you to live your life with more compassion and greater service. Calvin's Geneva was a church that existed to protect itself from the corrupting influences of the world outside its doors. It was a closed system bent on insulating itself at all costs from anything that was outside the accepted train of thought or practice. Outliers of all stripes were summarily rounded up and either reformed or killed, not just in Calvin's Geneva, but all over Europe on both sides of the Protestant-Catholic divide. But today, at 500 years removed, not just our church, but the church in the broadest sense, can, if we choose, exist for the exact opposite reason. Not to protect ourselves from the world and its corruptions, but to be of service to the world in its great need. Not to insulate ourselves from opposing viewpoints, but to be changed into more gracious and faithful human beings by the chance to be among those who disagree with us and love one another anyway. We do not exist in order to agree with one another all the time. We exist to be transformed and to transform the world into a place where the kind of forgiveness we offer one another might be possible. And so this foolish genius, this man who died to defend a faith we no longer care about, gave us this. Not this system of belief, but this way of being with one another. In this place, you will never burn for the heresy of choosing. In this place, you will never be rejected for following a different path. In this place, there is safety for your journey. And when the flames rise up in this place, they symbolize to us wisdom, courage, dignity, and love. In this place, the fire burns to remind us of hope instead of death. And you needn't be alone. And for that, we must thank every heretic who ever burned, for from those flames rose the freedom that gives us life.